Today is Friday, October 16, 2020. This is part two of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Kim Johnson, last name spelled J-O-H-N-S-O-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Kim. How are you?
Hi, Tom. Doing well.
Good. May we have your permission to record this interview over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Last time we wrapped up interview and you and I were talking, and you mentioned that you had been at Grand Canyon during the high water of 1983.
Mm-hmm.
Can you recall for me what you remember about that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, some of the things, you know, the whole thing was pretty spectacular, and kind of a lot of it. An example of lots of people sort of flying by the seat of their pants.
Okay.
And I do remember going up to Glen Canyon, and at that time the release was chewing its way through the sides of the rock and creating those big, great big holes there, you know, from the spillways or whatever.
That's right.
Yeah. And I remember... we were in the visitor center, and you could just feel the vibration in the building from that amount of water.
Wow.
Yeah. And you know, I remember when Kevin Fedarko interviewed me for the Emerald Mile book, I remember thinking, who other than a few river people would be interested in this, but I sort of didn't quite get it. But yeah, you know, I have a couple of funny stories.
Please. So before you mention it, I want to say, so you were at the visitor center when there was clear water going into the spillways and sediment-laden, very sort of tan water coming out the bottom?
Yeah. I don't remember that so much. What I do remember is the water that was, you could see down the spillway, was making itself a little hydraulic jump because of the angle and the velocity. The hydrologist could explain that better, but that was pretty fascinating.
Wow, you mean at the bottom or right at the top?
It was kind of in the middle, as I recall. I don't remember where...
You mean you could see it, though? You could see this weird...
Yeah, yeah.
Huh,
yeah.
Wow.
Anyway.
Wow. Okay, I'm sorry, I interrupted. You had a couple stories about that.
Yeah, no, probably the most famous story, of course, is that just don't make passengers like they used to. And my particular spin on that story is, so we were on a patrol trip, and I and Stan Steck were, I think we had kayaks, and we go, we all go to and scout Crystal, and Crystal actually was pretty washed out, but... We recall watching Georgie drive her triple rig and just get it stuck in the hole at Crystal, and she's just washing passengers off left and right. And so we kind of hurried up and decided to get after the passengers. And I was wearing a Park Service shirt, and that day, for some reason, I kept putting my oar handles in the shorts, the pockets of my shorts. And I really didn't want to do that in the middle of Crystal because, you know, you grab your oar. So I ran without any shorts on. And we make a long story short.
Make a long story longer.
All right. Well, we ran it. And
I'm going to jump in and back up a minute.
Okay.
So dress in the Park Service is important. How you wear your uniform, how it presents, is really important. And on the river, being as hot as it was, there was a move to get the river rangers into shorts, which was successful.
Yeah.
And so what you're saying is that the shorts had pockets. When you were rowing, you would get your oar handles caught in the pockets as you were rowing. You could.
Yeah, you could.
And that would be a mess because you need your orders to actually be actually doing something. Wow.
Yeah, right.
So you just basically take them off. And I'm assuming you're wearing a bathing suit and there's no problem. And it's like, no big deal. Yeah. Okay.
So anyway, so stands out in front and he's able to whip, because he's in a kayak, he's able to grab it was a guy and his daughter and maybe somebody else and paddle them over to the side. And I just remember, even in a raft, I ended up going overland to a guy that was, he might have gotten himself out. I can't quite remember if Stan got him out or if he got himself out. We were worried that he'd broken his leg because his leg was in a weird position. And
so this is somebody on the shore. You were able to pull the shore above or below them and then hike back to this guy?
Yeah, he must have been below me.
Okay.
I remember a couple things distinctively. Stan came back, and the guy was really shaken, obviously, but he was really scared for his daughter. And Stan was able to say, no, I got your daughter. Your daughter's fine. She's back on the raft with Georgie. And, I'd hike up to this guy. So now we got to get him back to my raft, which is parked, and the only way we're going to do it, because it was a wicked-ass climb to get to him, and he didn't have the ability to climb, plus to put him back in the river, which he didn't want to do. Mm. So Dan was kind of like playing lifeguard, you know, to the left of us, and I just shoved him in the river and swam behind him, and we floated down the eddy and got back to my raft, and then we all caught up with Georgie and gave her back her people, whom she didn't even know she was missing all of them. And that's when Terry hears the famous line, well, they just don't make passengers like they used to.
Yeah.
Which is a classic. So, but my point was, we were obviously pretty visible that day, and all the Harry stuff gets over with, and I reach around and I realize that in the whole thing of the day, I've kind of torn out one side of the butt of my swimming suit. So here's this park ranger, you know, kind of with her bare ass hanging out of her swimsuit. So I did the whole thing kind of mooning the passengers and everything. So,
well, you got done what needed to be done.
Yeah, we sure did.
When did you first become aware that there was problem with the dam?
You know, that's kind of way above my pay grade. I think we could see, looking at the forecast and looking at the fact that they hadn't put enough of a hole into the lake, but I don't remember if that was really clearly predicted, and I don't remember, or I wouldn't have been involved, frankly, in like Bureau of Rec in the Park Service.
Right. No, I was thinking more... Reclamation wanted the reservoir to be full on the 4th of July. That was their goal back then. Mm. And snowpack, who cares? It's up there, who cares? We want to be full for the 4th of July. The water started coming down. Reclamation eventually started opening up the generators.
Yeah.
And then the jet tubes. And that got them up to 40,000 CFS.
Yeah.
That would have... Anybody on the water would have been wondering, what's going on? Why is the water so high? When did you guys first get that inkling that, gee, I wonder why the water is so high?
Oh, I think we had information come from Bureau of Rec, because this is also sort of a little funny little thing. We knew we had people on the water. We knew the water was going to come up. We knew that they didn't know how high it was going to come up. So we went and flew the river and dropped notes to all the parties, which were going out to fly that mission, and we flew it out of Tucson. I'm not sure why. We go into the little 7-Eleven there, and we're buying baggies to put the little notes in, and the grizzled clerk at the store goes, well, you know, you're going to need some gravel to weigh those things down. Like, oh, yeah, duh, gravel. So I made the notes.
What did they say? Do you remember what they said?
What?
Do you remember what they said?
Well, yeah, I said Glen Canyon Dam release expected to go to whatever the number was by this time out of the dam. Camp High, Stay High, National Park Service, which was a very much of an insider, you know, a little tee-hee joke on my behalf. And somebody about 10 years ago kept their little note, and they put it up on my Facebook page, and they just thought it was hilarious, as did I.
Oh, fun.
Anyway, yeah.
Fun.
Inside moon.
I'll look for that. I'd love to see that.
It's somewhere buried on my Facebook, yeah.
Okay. Huh, I wonder if I can find it. That's great. So you're riding in a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And you must be going downstream, I'm supposing. And you would come across a river trip either on the water or on shore. And then you would like drop this baggie with some gravel and a note in it out the helicopter door?
Yeah, well, we probably ran that without doors, but it doesn't matter.
Okay, right. So there's no doors. You're strapped in.
Yeah.
And you just kind of, did you have like a bullhorn saying, hey, water's coming up, catch the note?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it was went pretty smoothly, and people were like, oh, it's the Park Service coming to tell us something.
Uh-huh. Okay, and you guys did that throughout the entire canyon?
Yeah, I think we only did that once though.
Okay.
But that was the big move up to 53 or whatever it was. So I think we only flew them once.
So this is when Reclamation decided to actually start using the spillways.
Yeah.
To basically start spilling.
Yeah.
Okay. Then eventually the spillways started to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And Reclamation realized they needed to stop the water going through the spillways. Because the water, as we mentioned, was going into the spillways clear and coming out of the spillways cloudy with lots of rock.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you see that down on the river, that the river had turned color? Or did it clear up again pretty quickly?
You know, I just don't recall. I don't recall either
okay.
way.
Okay. And of course, it would have been high, so it would have been churning up all kinds of river sediment as well. Okay. And it just kind of made this. They sort of spiked. It spiked up, went up to about 90,000 cubic feet a second, and they put the plywood out across the spillway.
Right. Yeah, I remember that. I remember thinking.
And the river dropped right back down again.
Yeah.
But at Crystal, where there was a fairly large rapid that had formed in the 1960s, a lot of river companies, like Georgie is a good example, sort of, you know, she just go down the middle of everything in her giant thrill craft, right. the three big pontoons tied together.
Yeah, yeah.
That run didn't work so well in Crystal.
Right. I mean, she surfed that boat in there. I don't know how, you know, I don't know how many, maybe three, you know, sloshes back and forth with people getting washed off every time.
Wow.
I mean, I think we were all thinking, oh my God, if this boat flips, we got a really big problem on our hands. But she didn't, so.
But then a Tour West boat did. And did Georgie have a fatality? Did she have a drowning?
That summer, I'm not sure. She had other drownings throughout her tenure. Yeah.
I just that phrase about, you know, they don't make passengers like they used to. I there's a story somewhere about one of the park rangers. You know, trying to interface with Georgie and a drowned passenger, and Georgie was like, "Get that body out of here, get that covered up. You're scaring my passengers."
Yeah.
But again, that's rumor from me. I wasn't there.
Yeah, I mean, she was a dude. So I spent quite a bit of time with her and her trips actually because, the Park Service was concerned about safety. A, and B, the Park Service was concerned about whether or not the quality of her trips was on par for what people were paying. And it was a super interesting juxtaposition because in some ways, who were we to tell Georgie White how to do things? She'd been running commercial trips since the 40s. And she was the real deal and probably more adventuresome and courageous than kind of all of us snotty little ranger kids rolled up into a ball.
Right.
I remember I'm about 5'8". She wasn't as tall as I am. And I've got ginormous hands for a woman. Her hands were even bigger than mine, and they were like hammer claws, and her hands were just unbelievably strong. But then you'd sort of be in camp, and she had all of the weird practices that she, her trips are known for, but including she would serve Manischewitz brandy at 4 in the afternoon. They would camp on these godforsaken beaches with no shade. Manischewitz brandy, and I want to say canned fruitcake. And then they would also make a punch with Everclear, right?
Right.
And maybe that had the Manischewitz brandy in the punch. But in some ways, it was your grandma serving this stuff. It was a real juxtaposition. And the boatman really liked it when I would show up because she would improve, or so they would tell me, there'd be more food around. Because that was also one of the complaints, is that the rations were a little skinny. But, that was, her people loved her for that. They weren't necessarily the people who wanted flambéed ice cream at night. They wanted the real experience. So, yeah, she was character.
Mm, interesting. Yeah.
Get Brian Dierkert sometime to tell you about the day that Georgie bet who could stand in the water longer. Brian Dierkert is a great big, you might know him, he's a great big guy.
Yeah.
And so Brian picks up Georgie and carries her into the river at Lee's Ferry. And you know how cold it is at Lee's Ferry, right?
Very cold.
And, it was big old Brian Dierkert who said uncle first, of course.
Hmm.
That might have been helped by a little bit of gin on behalf of Georgie or whatever. I can't remember what she drank, but... Yeah, so she's character.
Huh. Of the other riverners, let's see, this is in the early 80s. Gaylord Stavely would have been a longtime river runner, started running in 57 or 58. Georgie's first river trip in Grand Canyon was in 52 with Elgin Pierce, just the two of them on a raft. She flipped in Hants. Then started commercially mid-50s in Grand Canyon. And Gay Stavely, Frank Wright had sold out. Don Harris might have still been doing a couple trips in the 80s. I'm trying to think of who other of the long time, from the people from the 50s. Ted Hatch, if you could see him on the river. Then, of course, the people that came in later would be Martin Litton and George Wendt and these people that came in the 60s. But the people of the 50s, do you have any recollections of them?
I knew Stavely and Martin for sure. And Georgie, and I don't recall meeting Hatch.
I should actually regroup for Martin because his first river trip was in the mid 50s.
That makes sense. I don't know.
Okay. Just if you had any stories about those people.
Yeah, no, I have a Martin story, but it's not publication.
Okay. What else do you remember about that high water of 83?
Oh, I don't know. Silly things like the eddies were just full of crap. I mean, I remember running around in some eddy and picking up boxes and boxes of beers and frozen French fries and
From the jetsam coming out of boat coolers.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. After the boats were destroyed.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So you got in on a couple rescues. I know that Butch Farabee had talked about the Grand Canyon Scuba Diving Club, which he and J.T. Reynolds were members of. And, you know, I kind of laughed, but he said, no, wait, this was a real, legit, we trained, we practiced, we had the gear, tanks and fins and masks and all that stuff. And he mentioned launching out of a helicopter into the river. Well, it sounds like while you and Stan Steck were boat-based, he and JT were helicopter-based.
During the high water stuff, yeah.
And then I guess everybody got stopped at Phantom. All the trips got stopped at Phantom for a while the park kind of figured out whether it was safe to go ahead and run on down.
Yeah, right.
Did you meet Sam Steiger? Let's see. No, Deacon Cini. I guess it was Dennis Deacon Cini that came in. Arizona congressman.
No, I didn't.
Okay. Did you get a chance to go down to Phantom and see the big cluster of people down there?
No.
Okay.
We might have been on the other end of the river. I just don't remember.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So besides all the gear and the eddies, what else do you remember about that?
The power of the river was certainly impressive. In some ways, a lot of the stuff was just washed out. I think we all just didn't quite completely grasp the seriousness of the situation.
Okay. And it's interesting because Georgie was on the water in 1957 during the high, the high water of 57 that went up to 122 or 124,000 cubic feet a second.
Yeah.
She'd actually gotten tangled up, as had Frank Wright and Gay Stavely in 57. I think that was his first rowing trip with Frank. In a place just above Deer Creek, down below to Pete's Creek, the river goes into a place called the Granite Narrows.
Mm-hmm.
And the river's pretty wide, and then it tightens right up and goes right into this granite section. Did you get a chance to row a boat through there at high water?
You know, I must have, because we had to get out of there somehow, but I don't remember, on the, they don't make passengers like they used to. I don't remember. I mean, I'm not remembering anything. I don't think we were on that quite that high.
Okay.
At that point.
Okay. Yeah, the water ends up coming up on River Left, sheeting across the river surface into River Right, and then dropping down. So the whole current, instead of going downstream, is sort of doing a corkscrew thing in the river.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, things at 120,000 would be a lot different than 50.
Yeah, so, okay, that makes sense. So probably 50,000, it probably hadn't started to form that way yet. But certainly by 70,000, it was, by 70, 75,000, it was starting to really kick in gear there, that corkscrew effect in there. And I know that Georgie, her triple rig actually got pushed up against the wall, and she started doing a Georgie sandwich there against the wall. People ended up in the water, mm-hmm. It was an interesting deal there in 57 for her. She would have known that. She would have remembered that.
Maybe.
To be careful through there. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, any other Georgie stories? The guides were happy when you showed up because the food was better.
Yeah, right.
So in the end, the Park Service must have said, well, her trips are different, but her passengers really enjoy the experience they're getting, and so we're going to call it good.
Yes and no, to some degree. Jerking the permit of a concessionaire is a big deal, and you better have your ducks in a row. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. So did the Park Service just decide to let it slide?
I don't think let it slide would be the way I would describe it.
Okay.
I think that the Park Service felt like they had worked and encouraged boatmen and Georgie to be professional, up their skills, think a little bit more about safety, improve the quality of the experience, get you know, toe the line a little bit, I guess.
Okay, that makes sense. And when did you go to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Academy?
You know, it was probably 83 or 84. I don't remember the date.
And this was in Georgia?
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe your experience there, how that all worked out?
Well, yeah. The parks and rangers to a law enforcement, it's a 9-week course. It's law enforcement for land management agencies, so that's us, BLM, Forest Service, something else maybe. And it's at the Fletsy Center, which has everything from Border Patrol to Park Police to, I can't remember whatever else. So it's a pretty, you know, I liked it. I liked the classroom study stuff a lot. That's a lot of law, which I enjoyed, and we lived in the dorms and you know, met some interesting people,
who did you meet?
Oh, like I had a good friend who was a ranger at Biscayne Bay in Florida, and he was always talking about writing up reports for finding square grouper, those rangers' terms for bales of marijuana. Actually, I have a funny little story. We got done. I went to stay after Fletsy with him and his girlfriend or wife in Biscayne Bay, and the next day he's driving me in the runabout boat from his island to fly back to Miami, and they kind of warn you, okay, you've just been trained in law enforcement, be careful, don't have a hasty trigger finger, don't get yourself in trouble, you're a newly minted officer, you're kind of a danger to yourself. And so here we are, we're in place, we're not in uniform, we're not on patrol, he's just giving me a ride in the boat, and he looks up and he sees what looks like possibly drug smugglers, possibly throwing evidence, you know, throwing square grouper off in the ocean. And I'm like, I don't remember his name. So, you know, don't even think about making that contact, because if anything happens to you, well, A, we've got no cover on this boat. You know, it's aluminum or fiberglass boat, you know,
right.
How do we do this car stuff again? And I thought, and if anything happens to you, it's going to be me on the radio going, hi, this is little Kimmy Johnson, and I'm not sure where I am, but we're in the water here somewhere, and we've just taken down a bunch of drug runners, and they're coming after us, and the other guy's been shot, but I don't know where I am. Can you come and help me?
Right.
Like, come on, dude. So, anyway, and the other funny sort of Fletsy story, Fletsy was keeping a guy who'd worked undercover and had taken down a bunch of Hell's Angels types, and so because he needed to be protected, they went and hit him in Glencoe, Georgia, and he came and he lectured all of us about the parks at that time were having a lot of not necessarily problems, but big groups of motorcycle gangs would come in, and he was trying to get us to not take these guys lightly. And sort of like, you girl rangers, you have no idea how much the drug gang guys, or I'm sorry, the motorcycle guys, would love to chalk up raping a law enforcement officer. We're like, okay, we'll quit driving patrol all by ourselves and kind of knock it off and be more careful. And he was all still dolled up like a Hell's Angels guy, and he's passing around to us. We're like in a stadium seating, and he's got his colors that he wore or was part of. He ended up with it, and it's a motorcycle colors jacket and vest, and it was pretty interesting. And we're all looking at it and pawing it and passing it around, and he just laughs and he goes, "Y'all are such idiots. If you know how many times that thing's been shit on, pissed on, come on," and the thing just goes flying through the air. And I'm like,
I would imagine that the didactic training there would be very educational.
I mean, it's pretty. You learn how to drive the car fast. You learn how to shoot and PT, and then a lot of it's the law of law enforcement.
Yeah. And, this is a country based on laws, and to get a chance to be educated in how those laws work, how they're applied,
right.
That's a great education.
Yeah.
Who do you recall from your class?
There's a guy from Colorado. He was a forest ranger in Leadville, I remember that, and then this guy that I hung out with who worked at Biscayne Bay, and I was tutoring a guy who was from the park police, who was a great, big, strapping weightlifter guy, and he was just dumber than a box of rocks, and he could not pass his, he was doing a unit on drugs, and because he didn't have any practical experience, and he was not that smart anyway, he'd be like, okay, methamphetamine, meth is a hallucinogen?
Oh,
no.
Gosh. Huh?
Meth is amphetamine. Okay. Is LSD a hallucinogen? Yeah, very good. You're learning. Didn't happen.
Did he pass?
Yeah. And the other thing I remember really clearly was the Secret Service. We'd be in the locker room changing for gym or something, and the Secret Service girls who were trained there for a long time, and the Border Patrol also would come in. The Secret Service girls were pretty badass. These girls that were training for the Border Patrol were hardcore little 110 pounds of Hispanic angry energy in a ball. It's like, I'm kind of scared of these girls, but they had a tough curriculum. I mean, they would take all the candidates for Border Patrol and put them in a bus and tear gas them.
Wow.
So, they're all beat up. They all had shin splints. They're a mess.
Wow.
But, yeah.
Yeah, and the PT, as you mentioned, the personal physical training.
Mm-hmm.
Running, push-ups, pull-ups, just a whole drill of things. Some people wouldn't pass that.
Yeah, and we did you know, hand-to-hand, you know, martial arts and did some training and that kind of stuff too. So,
okay. So certainly tactical training. How do you take somebody down? And you have to do that in real time. And when people get taken down, they're wearing padding, and I'm assuming they were wearing some sort of padding and helmets and whatnot.
Yeah, you know, I don't know that we did a whole hell of a lot of that, but I do remember we did weapon takeaways, and what you learn really quickly is if somebody really has the guts and they really want to take your weapon out of your little pistol out of your hand, it's not that hard to do. You've got a shit ton of leverage.
Right.
You know, so, yeah, you hold that gun, you better be really committed that you're going to actually use it, so.
Right. Interesting. So did you come away from that? Was it a good course?
Oh, yeah, it was good.
Great.
So we all ended up, So I ended up with the commission, and the Inner Canyon people, the South Rim guys, the South Rim law enforcement guys, that's a pretty hardcore law enforcement gig, right? And one time, South Rim guys wanted to have a barbecue, so they put all the Inner Canyon guys in charge of the South Rim, because they were at a party and drinking and having hot dogs and stuff. And so I'm driving around in the patrol car and you know, look at us, hippy-dippy backcountry rangers. And I go over to the barbecue to get a hamburger, and the dispatcher comes on. Of course, all the South Rim guys got the radios on as well. And one of the things they train you in law enforcement school is a domestic disturbance is where you will get shot. So I get sent to a domestic in the campground, and the dispatcher says it's three girls. I'm like, okay, that doesn't sound too bad. And I get there, and it's a woman, her sister, and the sister's girlfriend who are together, and they're having a big old row. And irrelevant to the story. So I tell them to knock it off and quit fighting and blah, blah, blah. So I go back to the barbecue to get another hamburger or something. And the dispatcher comes on and says, that domestic you just went to, they're back at it. I'm like, all the South Rim guys are going, oh, you Inner Canyon people do not know what you're doing. What the hell? So I go back over there, and the three of them are just covered in sangria, and they've been fighting again. And the one woman who looked like she was the victim, she had a physical disability and maybe walking with a cane or something, and so we assumed that the other women, the couple, was beating up on the poor cripple girl. I guess I can't say that anymore. Anyway, so we really separated people, and I got a little bit of help with this, and I'm talking to the young woman with a disability, and I'm thinking she's just gotten the crap beaten out of her by her sister who was drunk and stuff, and she looks me straight in the eye, and she goes, "You don't think I bit my sister too hard, do you?" Anyway.
Yeah.
I used a technique taught to me by Kurt Sauer that night and took her out and gave her a sleeping bag and parked her in the far corner of the farthest campground I could ever find, because I couldn't find a hotel for her. I couldn't find anything for her. It was, you know, a very busy weekend, and then used the famous "Don't you ever set foot in my national park again" line, and, you know,
yeah,
let her out there, and we never heard from her again, thank God. So
it's interesting that there was a sort of a turf difference, and any of those South Rim law enforcement guys, if you put them on a boat and said, you know, "Well, this is Crystal, good luck." So it's like, wait a minute. Yeah, I can appreciate the different areas and your different skills, and you get good at that.
Right.
So it's kind of a good-natured humor. But But yeah, very different. South Rim Road Patrol versus Inner Canyon.
Yeah.
River, yeah. Backcountry Wilderness. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
And so that coming out of FLETC, you mentioned a commission.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, gosh, you're making me feel like I'm back in class. Basically, the agency, in this case, the Park Service, has the charter to establish requirements and training and stuff to then give you a law enforcement commission, and that's the same process that anybody that's a you hear the phrase sworn law enforcement officer.
Yep,
that's the same thing.
Okay.
So,
and that comes with a lot of responsibility. Because you have a weapon and you may be shot at.
Yeah.
But it also comes with some benefits of early retirement. I think it's a 20-year retirement track. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So it has its perks, but it also has its challenges.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair to say, yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, it wasn't without its risks. I think I told you last time we talked about Larry Vanslyke carrying around a new shipment of ceramic inserts for bulletproof vests because at the time, this was in the 80s, park rangers in Utah were being hunted down by militia members, and there was a very serious threat that we're not going to stop until the Virgin River runs red. So
right.
They were...
Right.
Very serious about it, and you know, a ceramic insert for your vest is an inch thick and weighs about 7 pounds, and it's made to stop hollow points. So, yeah, that was a very serious threat. So,
right.
Anyway,
and you know, there's you have to carry a duty belt which weighs a number of pounds.
Yep.
Pinches you when you sit down in the patrol car.
Yeah.
And you know, if you have to go for a run after somebody, that's, you know, flying around as well. And if you know where all that stuff is, if you're, you know, having a defensive tackle with someone.
Yeah.
So, that's a different type of responsibility there entirely. Yeah. Yeah. So, with FLETC, with commission now, did you take that back to the river then?
What's that?
Your commission, did you take that back to the river? Meaning, now you're on the river as a commissioned officer.
Yeah, I mean, I think we never wrote a lot of tickets. Sam and I one time found a guy who was doing an illegal trip. He was running an inflatable, a type of boat that you would use, like a dinghy. It wasn't a riverboat at all. And it had like a 20-horse motor on it that was sinking. We pulled all that in, and we cited the guy for running without a permit. And the law enforcement officer, he's the guy that kind of liaises, if you will, with the judge, wanted him cited into federal felony court in Phoenix, which I could just see this judge going, okay, we had murder one, we had rape, we had assault and battery. What's our next case? It's illegal boating, sir. It's what? So, I mean, it was the equivalent of really throwing the book at the guy, and
right.
And Park was pretty serious about making these arrests and citations for illegal boating stick. So, but that was, you know, so don't mess with that law enforcement officers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did do you remember who the magistrate was at the time?
I don't.
I wonder if that was Steve Verkamp.
I don't remember.
It was Thomas McKay was a magistrate, but he was there. Well, it could have been McKay.
Yeah, it could have been.
Would have been an older gentleman.
Yeah, don't remember.
Okay. And do you know if that went to federal court or whether they just handled it right there at the South Rim court?
No, it went to federal court, I think. Oh. I don't remember the disposition of the case.
Okay. Okay. We were talking last time, you mentioned Vernon Krueger, and I'm not sure how to spell Krueger's last name. K-R-U-G-E-R, maybe?
K-R-U-G-E-N, but, you know, I'm sure he's Googleable.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. What do you remember about his story?
Oh, he and whoever he ran with, they'd come to South Rim, and we met him, and we were like, they're going to run upstream and open boats. We're like, that's impossible. And
these were open canoes, right? They're like paddling a canoe.
And they went to their senator, who said, quit picking on the canoeing people. And so we gave him a permit and went, you know, but you can't do it. And sure enough, they did it. He was an impressive guy. And, you know, I don't know a lot about the details of some of the places that we thought would be impossible, but they did a ton of portaging and, you know, they made it work. So
he ended up writing a book about that. They were making basically a figure of eight around the country.
Yeah.
Up the Mississippi, down the Pacific coast, up Baja California, up the Colorado, and down the Atlantic coast, back to the Mississippi. This giant figure eight around the country. And so that was the one place that they couldn't get access was Grand Canyon National Park.
Yeah.
And I think it was Shearwall Rapid was the one place that gave them the hardest time because it's a sheer wall section of the river there in the Supai Gorge in Upper Marble Canyon, and they're in these little canoes and they couldn't just get out and go portage because there's a waterfall right into the river at the rapid there from the side canyon. But they made it.
There's other places too that we thought they could never do, like Sauk Dahlager, those Granite Gorge rapids above Crystal, but they did it.
Right, they crawled up into the schist and the granites and basically just were a couple hundred feet above the river working out portages.
Yeah.
Really tough. But absolutely amazing. Yeah, so more power to them for managing a muscle-powered uprun.
Right.
What do you remember about Superintendent Dick Marks?
You know, not a lot. I don't know at the time. I think the rank file didn't have, didn't see him as sort of, you know, our congenial, soft superintendent guy. But he and Haz were quite close with Kurt and Kurt's wife at the time.
Right.
And
Connor.
And I did it. Connor, and that kind of softened my impression, but I don't have a lot of, you know, I wouldn't have had a lot of interaction with him, and I don't remember, I don't remember taking him, well, maybe we did. So we were doing taking a bunch of Bureau of Reclamation bigwigs down, and I managed to flip in Crystal with a guy from the Bureau of Reclamation, hit my head, and for whatever reason, the guy was very Mormon, like a lot of the Bureau Rec guys were at the time, and all I could do was swear, and not like, you know, polite little girl swear words, pretty salty stuff, and we flew back in and were doing some more trips with people, and I remember, I think it was Dick Marks wanted to ride with me, because he figured there's no way I could get through Crystal, again, right side up, and if anybody was going to flip, it was going to be him with me, so... So, yeah.
And, of course, you didn't flip.
I didn't flip. Thank God.
Good deal. Fun. And then, How did things go from there? Did you stay on in the river unit? Then what happened?
Yeah, I did, and the river unit kind of slowly. JT moved to enforcement. Kurt went to probably Cascade.
Right. This was early 1984. I guess it was January.
Yeah. A guy that maybe wasn't well liked came from Yosemite and ran, which was then the Canyon District. I don't remember his name. I we'll just leave this part out. I felt like it would be tough. I felt like there was a class of guys ahead of me who were all competing for the same 20 jobs, and that it would have been very tough to continue to move up in the park. Huh. So, kind of end of an era, and so I quit the Park Service and went on to eventually end up in private business. So.
Okay. All right. Looking back now, do you think that was a good idea? I mean, it's looking back is always hindsight's always difficult.
Well, like I said, I didn't quite get that that the affirmative action advantage would have really helped me. But on the other hand, it's a little, hindsight's 2020. I think one of the things that would have been tough for me is because you move around so much, if you bring a partner who's got a portable job into the Park Service, teachers, doctors, stuff like that, when you do move around from park to park to park, that works well. But other than that, it might be kind of a recipe to stay single. And, I was aware of that. I probably would have had a very successful career and enjoyed it. And then, now all the guys that I worked with and around, they did, Kurt did well. Butch killed it, at the DC level. I don't know that I had the chops that those guys had, but... Kate, whatever her name was, Kate Cannon. Mm-hmm. She was assistant superintendent. I probably had a pretty significant disadvantage in that I didn't have a college degree, and at some point that might have been a disadvantage. So
yeah, you would have needed to go back and get that degree to keep advancing. Yeah, that was something that Kurt mentioned was you in order to advance. I mean, he met Larry Vance Slyke at college. Larry was back to get his degree because he could see that he wasn't going to proceed without it, and Kurt eventually did the same thing.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was always told, there was a Bureau of Reclamation guy who, I'll tell you the funny Peregrine Falcon story one time, but he was like, it was a guy from Resources Management, Larry, whatever his name was. Anyway, you'll regret not getting a degree. And in some ways, I ended up in technology working for companies that I was hired out by my consulting firm as a consultant, them not knowing I had no degree, because if they had known, they would not have hired me as a direct hire. I thought that was a little bit ironic. But, So that you want to hear the Peregrine Falcon story?
Yes, please.
And then I've got to go.
Okay.
What?
Yes, please.
So we've got this. A guy from Bureau of Rec, and he's a natural sciences guy, and we're down in the middle canyon there somewhere, maybe around Pete's or somewhere aside, and the guys were back hiking, and they come back, and they have a peregrine falcon with them that's sick, and the guy says, "You've got to call a helicopter. We've got to get this thing out of here." I'm like, "No, that's crazy. Do you know what that's going to cost?" He's like, "Do you have any idea how much money we spend on peregrine falcon reintroduction, habitat management, peregrine falcon management in general? Like, okay, but if I get fired, it's your fault, and your agency's going to pay for the helicopter." So we, at the time, the way we got a hold of the park was we would, because we didn't have sat phones, we would mirror flash aircraft. And so Kurt gets a mirror flash, knows we're on the river. The mirror flash was from the location that was close to where we would be. So now he's thinking, oh, God, who's hurt? So he and the helicopter pilot named Tom, I can't remember his last name, come barreling in on us, pretty hot, and they get on the radio, and they go, what's wrong? We're in a hurt Peregrine Falcon. Guy flares the helicopter up, goes up to about 1,000 feet above ground level. You can see, you can hear the silence. Kurt finally comes back on the radio and goes, you got a what? So I go on to explain, you know, the Bureau of Rec Life says we got to get this Peregrine Falcon out of here, and he's going to pay for it. And so finally, Kurt and the guy land the helicopter, and by this time they brought the little, well, he wasn't little, but brought the Peregrine Falcon down, and somebody put a bandana around his head as a hood, like you do with birds of prey.
Right.
And
right.
They get in the helicopter. I think he was pretty skinny. He obviously was pretty sick, and. The funny little coda to that story is they get about two-thirds of the way back, and they finally Kurt just can't stand it. He grabs the hood, picks it up. The Peregrine Falcon just nails him on the chin and bites him.
Wow.
Yeah. But I always thought it was very ironic, you know, Peregrine Falcons are the fighting machine in the air of the
parade. Yeah.
They'll take out a duck.
Yes.
And here's a Peregrine Falcon in a helicopter. I thought that was pretty
trying
cool.
Trying to take out the guy in the helicopter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, Tom, I've got to shove off for now. So,
all right.
As always, it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
I'll wrap this up. Hang on a second. This is going to conclude part two, Grand Canyon Oil History interview with Kim Johnson. Today is Friday, October 16, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. And Kim, thank you so very much.
Thank you.